Okay, we do just three half bells. Did anybody lose a recording device? Perhaps last week? A little hand recorder? You weren't here last week, were you?
I recorded from the internet.
Excuse me?
I recorded through the internet. I attended the class through the internet.
Yeah, but somebody lost a little recorder last week. It was found on the path in the monastery.
It looks like Richard's.
I see.
Similar size.
I see. Okay, I'll ask him. Okay, we can begin with salutations for the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, today we'll be taking sutta number 19 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is called the Dvaita Vitakka Sutta, which is translated the two kinds of thought, or twofold thought. And this sutta takes the form of the Buddha relating his own experience in training his mind before his enlightenment. So, occasionally within the discourse collection, we find suttas in which the Buddha speaks about his experience as what we call a bodhisattva, that is, an aspirant or a seeker of enlightenment. And whenever he does so, usually it's for the purpose of, let's say it has a pedagogical purpose, that is, the purpose is to impart some kind of instruction to us, Or in other words, the Buddha is like setting himself up as a model for those who are following the path to enlightenment to emulate, to try to follow the same experience or the same type of training that the Buddha himself had to undergo in order to reach enlightenment. Okay, so in this sutta, the Buddha is going to explain to us the methods that he used for training his thoughts. And so the key word in this sutta, the word that gives its that's responsible for the title of the sutta, is the word vitakka. Okay, this word vitakka is based upon the stem is the word chakka, which the way it was used in the Buddha's time takes on the meaning of reasoning or logic. But then the word vi, when it's the particle vi is prefixed to it to form the word vitakka, and that gives it very much the sense of thinking or thought. And it refers to ordinary thinking as well as to a particular mental function. This is when we come to the Buddhist way of analyzing the mind into distinct mental factors, each with their own function. The word vitakka becomes one of these particular mental functions, which is said to have the task of applying the mind onto its object. And so we see the word vitakka in this special sense used in the formulas for the jhanas. So within the first jhana, there is no thinking going on in the ordinary sense of discursive thinking, reflection, pondering a particular topic. But there is still the mental function of applying or directing the mind onto an object. And that function is ascribed to vitakka. In this case, vitakka, it's often coupled with another word, vichara. Vichara is another one of these mental factors which has the function of, maybe we can say, examining the object or observing the object. The word vichara itself originally meant something like wandering. But this is not the mind that wanders away, the roaming and wandering mind, but it's a mental function which continually anchors the mind onto the object. So vitakka applies the mind to the object, and vichara observes the object. And these two mental functions are present in the first jhana, the first meditative absorption, but they fall away as one moves from the first jhana to the second jhana. So in the second jhana, there's no function of directing the mind onto the object, and no function of the mind examining the object, probably because the degree of concentration has become so strong that there's no longer a need to direct the mind onto the object or to stand apart observing the object, but the mind is completely absorbed in the object, completely focused on the object. So this is the way the word vitakka is used in relation to the jhanas, the meditative absorptions. But in its ordinary usage, the word vitakka, it's very much similar to the English word thought, though it has here not so much the intellectual sense of thought, but rather what I would call maybe the purposive sense or motivational sense, that it's thinking which has a purpose behind it, thinking which is motivated, thinking which is directed towards some kind of goal. And in this sense, vitakka, it's often rendered or equated with another word that occurs in Pali. That word is sankappa. Now, the reason I write this Pali word sankappa, I don't want to confuse you with too many Pali words, but this word has an important role in the Buddha's teaching. Does anybody know what that role is? What is it?
Can I take a guess?
Yeah.
Five
arguments? No. What is it? Speak more loudly. Right, okay. It's what she said is correct. It's the second factor in the Noble Eightfold Path is sammasankappa. That means right, sometimes it's translated right thought or right intention, right purpose, right motivation. And then the opposite of that is called michasankappa. That means wrong thinking, wrong purpose, wrong motivation. Okay, and so this sutta, though it's formulated in terms of vitakka, that is thought, it's concerned really with the development of the second factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, that is with replacing wrong thought with right thought, wrong purpose with right purpose. And there are different ways in which thought or purpose can function as the second factor of the Noble Path, Noble Eightfold Path. One, we could say, is the way one formulates one's purposes at the very outset of training in the Noble Eightfold Path, or something that one repeatedly reminds oneself, of which one repeatedly reminds oneself every day, for example. So at some point every day one can remind oneself that it is one's purpose in applying the Noble Eightfold Path or following the Noble Eightfold Path to overcome wrong thought, wrong purpose with right purpose, right motivation. But even though one establishes this right motivation at the beginning of one's training, even though one repeats it on a day-by-day basis, But still, in the course of one's day-to-day life, even when one is supposedly sitting quietly in meditation, but sometimes wrong thoughts or wrong purposes, wrong motivations arise. So then in order to train the mind, we have to recognize these wrong thoughts, wrong motivations, and then we have to find a way to weaken them, and then to replace them with right purpose, right aim, right thinking. And so in this sutta, the Buddha is going to describe how he did that. Okay, so he starts off by saying, before my enlightenment, while I was still only a bodhisattva, not yet enlightened, it occurred to me, suppose that I divide my thoughts into two classes, two groups. So here we could see that the Buddha is training his mind, and in order to assist himself in the training of the mind, he comes to a recognition that thoughts fall into two classes. Now, usually our minds just run from thought to thought. We have different aims, different purposes, but we don't yet really see and understand what I would call the ethical implications of these thoughts, where they are leading us, whether they are leading us to suffering, to affliction, to bondage, or whether they're capable of leading us to purity, to freedom, to enlightenment. Okay, but now the Buddha, as a bodhisattva, he's one who set out seeking enlightenment, and he recognizes the need to distinguish these thoughts, to distinguish them in terms of their ethical quality, and to recognize where they are leading, what their ultimate impact will be on himself and on others. And so he now establishes, in order to make a very neat, concise scheme, he lays out three kinds of unwholesome thoughts and three kinds of wholesome or beneficial thoughts. Okay, the three kinds of unwholesome thoughts are thoughts of sensual desire, thoughts of ill will, this would be include anger, hatred, resentment, and thoughts, here it's translated cruelty, but maybe cruelty is a little too narrow. A broader meaning might be harming, thoughts of harming others. And then he set on the other side the three opposite kinds of thoughts. The first is translated here, thought of renunciation. But I'm going to explain how I think it's possible that this might actually be, how to call this, a wrong representation of that Pali word because of the process of textual transmission. I'll explain that in a moment. Okay, so thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of non-ill will, and thoughts of non-cruelty. Now, usually in Buddhism, when we speak about the three unwholesome roots, what are the three unwholesome roots?
Greed, hatred, delusion.
Right. Greed, hatred, and delusion. And so it might seem a little puzzling at first. Why we don't have the unwholesome thoughts set out as thoughts of greed, okay, sensual desire, greed, almost synonymous. Thoughts of ill will, thoughts of hatred would be almost synonymous. But we say deluded thought and thought of cruelty Not very close, not very similar. So why don't we have thoughts of delusion here? Doesn't it seem like something is missing?
Delusion is not a fault.
Actually, that's a good...
It's all delusion?
No, no, that would be an extreme, yeah. But there's another reason I have in mind.
Well, I think the delusion is the quality of the thought, not what the thought is about.
Actually, that's a good point, too, though it's not exactly what I had in mind. We say that delusion is certainly is a quality, let's say, that's often associated with thoughts of sensual desire, thoughts of ill will. Did you?
I was thinking the truth and untruth and the discovery in that direction. Maybe it's not that because delusion is more about discovery.
Yeah, but then why wouldn't there be thought of untruth or untrue thought?
Yeah.
Wait, look, Jin will give you the microphone.
I think it's because delusion is not easily to be recognized at the very beginning.
Actually, that's a very good point, too. But again, it's not quite what I had in mind. Maybe somebody has to read my mind to know what I have in mind. Let us say it's is delusion in some way included in the wrong Eightfold Path in some form? Did you raise your hand? No?
Mindfulness, are you relating it to?
No,
right.
No.
Michaditi?
That's what I was looking for. Michaditi, it's what?
Wrong view.
Wrong view. So wrong view isn't quite the same as delusion, but we could say that wrong view, it's a kind of manifestation of delusion or an outgrowth of delusion. So already wrong view is being corrected by the first factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, that is, by right view. So when one has right view, that is countering delusion. Even though delusion is very deeply rooted, so delusion is only completely eliminated when one reaches the end of the path, that is, true knowledge or enlightenment. But already, when one acquires the right view, one is activating that particular path factor that is opposed to delusion. And so delusion, I would say, refers, both delusion and wrong view refer to understanding that's kind of distorted. Let's say delusion is lack of right understanding, and wrong view is a crystallization of wrong understanding. It's a concrete manifestation of wrong understanding. But when there's wrong understanding, distorted understanding, that will have an impact on our motivations, that will affect our purposes, our aims. And so we have to deal with this motivational side of the mind. It's almost a separate exercise. So that's why there comes the separate training in developing right view. But then a question comes up that cruelty and ill will seem to be very closely associated. So what exactly is the difference between them? Why are the two?
One is thought and one is action.
Well, here they're both taken as thoughts.
In this particular...
Yeah, yeah. Okay. I would say that what's translated cruelty here In fact, maybe you're getting warm that it manifests in the form of action. In a way, I'd say, yeah, that you're on the right track, though it's not exactly...
I'm exactly wrong.
Excuse me?
Well, I was making a joke. I'm not exactly wrong.
Yeah, well, anyway, maybe I'll just give my explanation. And this is my understanding. It doesn't come in the text itself, or not even in the commentary. But there's a tendency for this third factor to express itself in action, in harming of others. Whereas ill will is more a kind of emotional state of the mind.
Wouldn't be thinking about it and the other enjoying thinking about it?
I think the word cruelty in English suggests the enjoyment of inflicting harm on others, which is one reason why I don't think it's a perfectly satisfactory translation of the word. The original Pali word is vihinsa, which means simply harming others or inflicting harm on others. So it doesn't imply anything that necessarily imply getting enjoyment out of that, for a kind of sadistic pleasure from it. But it doesn't definitely imply a certain tendency that breaks out in the form of action. And so we have the Pali word is abhihinsa, but many of you will probably have heard it in a slightly different form. It's almost been absorbed into English. The Pali word that's translated here, cruelty or harming, is vihinsa. But this is really, the stem is hinsa with the prefix v, which just has the effect of strengthening it a little bit. So it means harming or harmfulness. And the negation of this, what is translated here as non-cruelty, in Pali, it's avihinsa. But if we just leave out the prefix, then we have ahinsa. We don't have to use the accent marks. Do you recognize this word, ahinsa? It's almost become an English word, meaning non-injury, non-harming. So it was Mahatma Gandhi took that as one of the principles of his attempt to win freedom for India from British rule. He adopted the policy of ahimsa, non-harming, non-violence. In fact, the word that's become quite widespread in English now, non-violence, like non-violent resistance, actually has come into English through Gandhi's adoption of the policy of ahimsa. Then this was translated as nonviolence and then adopted by Martin Luther King and others who followed principles of nonviolence. We say nonviolent resistance to oppression, injustice, and so on. Okay, so I think the Buddha incorporated this non-cruelty, non-harming, non-violence into the path because the thought of violence or of harming becomes the source of so much behavior and action which results in the destruction of life, the injuring of others, wars, violence, and so on. And so in order for his followers to train effectively in observing the principle of nonviolence in their day-to-day life, of harmlessness, they have to begin at the level of thought, purpose, motivation, by developing thoughts of nonviolence and removing the tendency to violence, to harming others. Okay, I said I was going to deal with this, what's called the wholesome thought, the first wholesome thought, which is translated as here thought of renunciation. And this has come about because there are two derivations for the Pali word, which are different, but they culminate in the same word. Can I take this out? Okay, the word that's translated as sensual desire or sensuality is the word kama. Like we know of, there's the famous Indian text called the Kama Sutra, which is the scripture of sensual pleasure. Okay, now the prefix which is used for negation in Pali and Sanskrit is near, plus kama. Gives us nikama. Then when this gets transformed, that means desireless. And then when this is transformed into an abstract noun, it turns into nekama. Which would be desirelessness or lack non-sensuality. But there's another. There's a verb. In Pali, it's kam. But in Sanskrit, it's kram. Which means to step, to walk. And when you put the prefix near in front of it, N-I-R, we get the verb nikamati, which means literally to step out, to walk out, and then this takes on the meaning of to renounce. And then to make the noun from this verb, it turns into nekama. So we get two words with different derivations which come out to be the same word. So nekama, it's the act of stepping out or renunciation. But there's another word, nekama, which means desireless. It's a little bit like in English. We have the two words. We have wind and wind. So this is why English is so confusing for people who are learning it as a second language. Will you please wind my watch? The wind is blowing. Okay, so it's uncertain exactly what was the original meaning of nekama. Is it derived from near plus kama, desirelessness? Or is it from near plus kamati, to step out, to renounce? Okay, so anyway, we have these three unwholesome thoughts, and they're directly opposed by these three wholesome thoughts. And so now the Buddha is going to show how he trained his mind to overcome these unwholesome thoughts. So he says, now I'm in paragraph 3, we're on page 207. As I abided thus, that is after dividing his thoughts into these two classes, as I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of sensual desire arose in me. Sometimes people adulate and the Buddha or put him up on a pedestal that he couldn't do anything wrong because all of his thoughts are always perfect. But here he's saying, when I was striving for enlightenment, sometimes a thought of sensual desire arose in me. Don't forget that the Buddha came from the princely class. He would have been living in the palace. He would have had dancing girls all the time, and music, entertainment, delicious food, anything he wants. He just snaps his fingers and there are servants to provide it for him. And so those thoughts would arise in him, probably memories of his enjoyments in the palace. And so how does he deal with this thought? So he uses the power of reflection to overcome that thought by considering the consequences of it. So he thinks, this leads to my own affliction or harm. This leads to others, the affliction of others, and to the affliction of both. So what one does is to draw out the consequences of these thoughts. So with the thought of sensual desire, the Buddha will think, now the Bodhisattva, of course, just to indulge in some degree of sensual enjoyment for an ordinary person, it's not in any way a breach, violation of precepts or ethics. But for somebody who is striving with full diligence in order to reach the utmost perfect enlightenment, then this thought of sensuality, of sensual enjoyment, it's going to be a temptation that will, it's tending to pull him away from the path. Like this is the voice of Mara. Mara comes to the Buddha sometimes when he's struggling for enlightenment and says, why are you striving so diligently? You can go back to the household life, you can live in the palace, you can enjoy yourself and do deeds of merit, and you'll have a happy rebirth. Okay, so enjoying sensual pleasures is not itself necessarily an obstacle to spiritual progress. But if one is aiming at that very life to reach the utmost enlightenment, the ultimate enlightenment, then it becomes a barrier. And so reflecting in this way, the Buddha might have worn away that thought or eliminated that thought. Then by considering that this thought leads to the affliction of others, Okay, so the Buddha could have reflected that if I follow through this thought, act upon this thought, then I won't reach the utmost enlightenment, and then I can't show the way to liberation to others. And then to the affliction of both, this just brings the two together. It obstructs wisdom, it causes difficulties or distress, and it leads away from Nibbana. Okay, so when I considered this, in each case, he takes each of these individually, when I reflected, this thought leads to my own affliction, then that thought subsided. When I considered, this leads to the affliction of others, the thought subsided. When I considered, this leads to the affliction of both self and others, then that thought subsided. Similarly, when he reflected, this obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties or distress, and leads away from Nibbana, it subsided in me. So whenever a thought of sensual desire arose in me, I abandoned it, removed it, did away with it. Okay, so this is a useful method. And it's a method that one doesn't apply just one time, but it's by continually, repeatedly reflecting on what is called the danger or the drawbacks, the disadvantage in these unwholesome thoughts, that one weakens their power, weakens their grip on the mind. So this is a gradual process. One can't expect simply to do away with these thoughts all at one shot. But it's a process of training oneself by reflecting a little bit now and then on the drawbacks, the disadvantages in these thoughts, the misery to which they lead, that one can weaken them. I'd actually found this method very, very useful during my early days as a monk. I mean, if the Buddha himself was a bodhisattva, could have thoughts like that. A very ordinary person like myself, in my early days as a monk, those thoughts would come up. And then I had read the sutta, so I thought, let me just apply that method. And I started reflecting on these thoughts, okay, sensual thoughts in that light. And they weren't thoughts about delicious food or going to movies, but other things. But reflecting on that way, in that way, you know, if I follow through on this thought, I'm going to give up my monk's life and go back to the worldly life. And then I lose that advantage for myself. I lose the ability to be of real benefit to others. And then I won't be able to follow the way to this development of the higher wisdom and Nibbana. And so as I reflected in that way, I found it was very, very effective in weakening the power of that type of thought. And so we find quite a number of suttas in which the Buddha explains or gives methods for debilitating the power of sensual thoughts. For example, there's the contemplation of the parts of the body. We find in the Satipatthana Sutta, the 31, 32 parts of the body. The reflection on the corpse in the cemetery, also in the Satipatthana Sutta. Then we have suttas like number 75, let's say number 54 in the Majjhima Nikaya. You have the Potaliya Sutta. This has the similes for sensual desire. And Sutta number 75 in the Majjhima Nikaya, which is a kind of long examination of the unsatisfactoriness of sensuality. Okay, so then the Buddha applies the same method to the other two types of thoughts. As I dwelt thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of ill will arose in me. We think the Bodhisattva had boundless, infinite loving kindness, boundless compassion. But still, because he was not yet fully enlightened, there was maybe some tendency for ill will to arise. I don't know how that could have happened. Maybe. I remember one monk in Sri Lanka told me there's a sutta in which the Buddha says that, he says to Ananda, "Ananda, I'm now growing old, my skin is wrinkled, my hair is turning gray." And this monk in Sri Lanka told me, our Sinhalese people, they don't like to hear about the sutta. They always think the Buddha remains about 40 years old. Always the skin is fresh and bright and the hair is always black. Okay, but here he says, sometimes a thought of ill will would arise in me. Maybe when he joined some of the groups of the other meditation masters and was studying together with some of the other disciples, there was some degree of like competition, and maybe the other disciples resented the Bodhisattva, and so maybe they tried to do things to slur his reputation, and maybe that would cause some degree of ill will to arise in him. Or even if he's meditating outdoors and then a heavy rainstorm comes, he might get a little bit angry because of the weather, or if it's too hot, or if flies and mosquitoes come and start biting his flesh, then he'll get upset with them. And then also a thought of vihingsa would arise in him. A thought of, I can't imagine cruelty arising in him, but a thought of harming, again, maybe with mosquitoes and flies come. I mean, I had to struggle with this. My early, first couple of years in Sri Lanka, they didn't give me mosquito nets. Even my first night at the temple where I was to be ordained, I didn't sleep that night. I thought, as the afternoon was wearing on, my first night there, my first day there, oh, so what wonderful place, quiet village, everything is like, this is real Asia, Sri Lanka, South Asia, so different from America. And the room was very peaceful, very quiet. Then my 7 p.m., it was getting dark, I thought, let me just sit in meditation. So I start sitting, and then there comes a little buzzing sound. Buzz, buzz, wee, 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 wee. Then it lands on my arm. And a little pinprick into the arm. Then, again, more buzz, buzz, buzz. Till by 7:30, my body was just covered with every exposed inch of flesh of the body was covered with a mosquito. And this continued. You see, when I was living in America, before going to Sri Lanka, I had this state of mind, if there's one mosquito in the room, it takes me hours to fall asleep. Even if the mosquito doesn't land on me, but just the buzzing in the room, it creates this worry or anxiety, he's going to come for me. So I lie there thinking, when is he going to... It's the female mosquito that bites, I think. When is she going to come for me? When is she going to come? Until usually I would fall asleep, but after an hour or so of just lying. But here in my ideal paradise, the room was just thick with mosquitoes. This was early November. Yeah, early November, which is the rainy season. And the rainy season is the time when the mosquitoes breed and they come out in abundance. And so after some time I got used to having mosquitoes around. But they would come. The first year I didn't have the mosquito net, and they would come and land on me, and I just had to train. But it's so tempting to think that all I have to do is give up this determination and just take my hand and just one whack. It'll only take 2 seconds, and then peace and quiet and freedom from pain. Of course, that's the delusion. Because you get rid of one, and it means just like somebody in the movie theater or the restaurant gets up and leaves their table, the crowded restaurant, then there's somebody else waiting online to come in and start eating. So there's a whole, you know, flock of mosquitoes on the wall waiting for a space to open up. A table on Bhikkhu Bodhi's arm. Then the master of ceremonies will come, the host to that mosquito will say, "Would you like a table? How many in your party?" Okay, we have 4 mommy, daddy, and the 2 kids. Okay, so the thought of ill will and cruelty arises. And using the same method of reflection, the Buddha is able to overcome those thoughts. Okay, now the Buddha draws out the lesson. And this is an important lesson, very important lesson. Paragraph 6. Because he's speaking to the monks, he formulates it in terms of the monks, but it's true of any person. So I'm going to just substitute for bhikkhu, I'm going to say person. So whatever a person frequently thinks and ponders, that will become the inclination of the mind. We would say that becomes the habitual tendency of the mind. If one frequently thinks and ponders thoughts of sensual desire, then one has abandoned the thought of renunciation or the thought of desirelessness to cultivate the thought of sensual desire. And then one's mind inclines to thoughts of sensual desire. Similarly, if one frequently thinks and ponders thoughts of ill will, thoughts of cruelty, then one abandons the thought of non-ill will, the thought of non-cruelty, to cultivate the thought of ill will, the thought of cruelty, and then one's mind inclines to thoughts of ill will or to thoughts of cruelty. And so we could see that our habits and our character, how do they develop? Why are we born with a particular character, certain tendencies, certain aptitudes, certain inclinations? It's not that there's some kind of, maybe you look at the astrology book and you think this is something written in the stars, or you think that there's some God who gives you your character, puts it into your mind. But the character is actually built up by our individual thoughts. So it's like the character is the sum total of our thoughts. So there's a saying, I don't know where it originates, but I've read it in different places. Plant a thought and you reap a habit. Replant a habit and you reap a character. Plant a character and you reap a destiny. So our destiny in life, it's not something determined outside of ourselves, but it's basically a function of our character. And our character, it's built up out of our habitual thinking. So we could say the inclinations or predispositions of the mind. And the predispositions are determined by our individual thoughts. So he could have somebody who is of an extremely sensual character, maybe somebody like Don Juan or a Casanova. So this kind of character, it's built up by, again, over maybe several lives, repeatedly thinking and pondering thoughts of sensuality. For somebody who is, you know, continually obsessed by sensual thoughts, the sensualist. Then we have the other person, you know, just as soon as he walks in the room, you get what they call bad vibrations. The face really looks hard, rough, threatening, dangerous. You don't even have to talk to the person very long, but they just, you've never seen them before, but they walk into the room, you look at the face, you get that impression. That's the character of the thoughts showing through the face. This could be a really angry person. So when you see the angry person, immediately you get the vibrations of anger or ill will. And then another person who is, you know, really violent, rough, explosive temperament. And those temperaments are built up from just letting their thoughts roll through the mind without making any attempt to cultivate them, to train them. Okay, so now the Buddha gives a simile for this. Okay, it's like in the last month of the rainy season, in the autumn, when the crops thicken, then the cowherd would guard his cows by constantly tapping and poking them on this side and that with a stick to check and curb them. And why is that? Because he sees that he could be flogged, imprisoned, fined, or blamed if he lets the cows stray into the crops. So too I saw in unwholesome mental states the danger, degradation, and defilement, and in wholesome mental states the blessing of renunciation, the aspect of cleansing. So the simile here, it's quite appropriate, because when the crops are thick, then the cattle will walk towards the crops and start to eat them. And so to keep the cow away from the crops, one has to treat them a little bit roughly by tapping them, poking them, hitting them, so that they'll move away from the crops. So sometimes this is how one has to train the mind. One has to hit these unwholesome thoughts, keep the mind away. Let's say the unwholesome thoughts are like the grain, and the mind is like the cow. So one has to strike the mind with these reflections on the danger, degradation, and defilement in unwholesome thoughts, and that way pull the mind away from the unwholesome thoughts towards the wholesome. Okay, any questions on this so far? Okay. Nina?
In the example of the mosquitoes, wouldn't you also think of the consequences of being bitten and using reason? So, I mean, you know, the option to that could be malaria.
Okay, in the area where I was living, there was no malaria.
Oh, okay. Okay. And the word nikama,
yeah,
is that in Pali or Sanskrit?
The word nikama, which of the words?
the nikama.
Nikama.
Right.
At the down here. This is the Pali form.
Okay.
Okay, but now
in Hindi that means useless. So it's, I was a little confused.
Don't read the Hindi meaning into that. Hindi is derived from, it belongs to the same family of languages, but the word could have picked up different meanings over time. Maybe the idea came that a person who is renounced, left the worldly life, is useless.
Thinking back in your question about why non-cruelty rather than referring to delusion,
yeah.
Again, I might be making the same confusion that Nina was, but I once interviewed an Indian scholar who translated ahimsa as non-violation rather than non-violence.
Mm-hmm.
Robin Ravindra retranslated it.
Excuse me.
Which the man's name was Ravi Ravindra, and he said he thought non-violation was more exact to the original meaning.
Mm.
And it seems that, you know, we can often give aid, even, and it does harm.
Yeah.
There's a violation, you know, individually or even as a country.
Yeah.
Because we're deluded.
Yeah.
And anyway, I just wondered if you'd ever come across non-violation or violation.
I never came across that before, but it's an interesting interesting suggestion. However, what I would say that this is now, it's, as far as the thought goes, it's referring to intention. So if one has a good intention, say of aiding others, but in some way, because of unforeseen consequences, it leads to harm, that one wouldn't be at fault for an unwholesome thought or unwholesome intention.
That's true. But a deluded thought, a lack of discernment or a lack of awareness could be a kind of, I don't know, just a kind of violation.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, violence is actually too strong because there can be ways of harming others which are not violent, but they still have a malicious intention behind them. Okay, I think Richard had a question.
The Romans had a saying that man is a wolf to man, and the verb is often used for this. It was violare, to violate. Man is violare, a violator. The English word fuck, the root is from the Egyptian word to beat with a stick. And so I'm thinking that we have this link of sensuality, ill will, and cruelty. And I'm thinking that in his time, particularly in his position, since he was a prince and had such authority, and as a male also, complete authority over women, that he may have regarded a thought of sensuality particularly as potentially cruel, as afflicting somebody else, because he knew perfectly well that he had rights over all the women in the palace, and that he could violate their will at any time, because he would always be judged right and they would always be judged wrong in resisting him. And so it may be that's why those three things go together for him.
I'm not so sure that would be the case. I mean, it might be, what you said might have been the case with him, but I'm not sure that is the reason why he included the thought of sensuality amongst the unwholesome types of thoughts.
Is the word sensuality, desire, that is for him, that is to act on desire, meant that he could not be resisted right? And so that...
That might have been...
He knew that...
That might have been true in his own case, but I think for many that were training under him, he would still caution them against sensuality, but of course in that society, the male always had the authority over the female.
Yeah.
But I think he just saw that there was an intrinsic obstacle in sensuality itself, because it's a form of craving, not necessarily because it leads to some kind of violation of others.
Well, it's certainly treating someone else as an object, like in Kantian terms, it's not recognizing someone else's subjectivity.
Yep. Okay, we'll take one more question, then I'll have to go on.
She's just a classification. Whenever the text mentions sensual desire, it's just desire, the six senses.
Okay.
When the sutta mentions about sensual desire, it's not just sensuality, but the desire of the six senses, well, five senses and the mind. What's the exact meaning of sensuality?
Usually it's desire for the enjoyment of the pleasures of the senses. Of course, one could be thinking about those enjoyments with the mind, so one doesn't have to need the actual sense object in one's presence. But it's referring to the enjoyment of the senses.
And not just sensuality, thoughts of sensuality, right?
Well, that is a sort of sensuality. It's not thinking about sensuality itself, but it's thinking about enjoying sense pleasures.
I think what you mean is not just sexuality.
Exactly.
We tend to talk about sexuality.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Okay, okay.
The other senses can do it.
So it has a broader meaning. Yeah, a broader meaning.
Thank you.
Okay, I want to go on because I want to finish this sutta. Okay, now he continues by explaining how he practiced. Okay, he says that as he was, now I'm in paragraph 8, as he was training in this way, he would use a method of reflecting on the thoughts, and that would cause these thoughts to subside in him. And so he says, if I think and ponder upon this thought, even for, here we come to the thoughts, the wholesome thoughts with paragraph 8. As I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, the thought of renunciation arose in me. I understood thus, this thought of renunciation, or maybe desirelessness, has arisen in me. This does not lead to my own affliction, or to others' affliction, or to the affliction of both. It aids wisdom, it does not cause difficulties or distress. It leads to nirvana. Okay, so this is the way of encouraging these wholesome thoughts to arise. So, while those thoughts are still relatively weak when they need to be strengthened, he would reflect on the advantages in those thoughts. Again, this is the usual Indian way is to express this negatively. It doesn't lead to my own affliction. It doesn't lead to the affliction of others. But more positively, you could say that this leads to my own benefit. It leads to the benefit of others. It leads to the benefit of both. Then it aids wisdom. It contributes to the arising of wisdom. It does not cause difficulties, distress, worry, anxiety, and it leads to nirvana. So those are the positive aspects of this thought. But now he considers further, he says, if I think and ponder upon this thought, even for a night, even for a day, even for a night and day, I see nothing to fear from it. So he sees that this thought is beneficial and that he could go on reflecting on the benefits of the thought of renunciation again and again. But now he says, with excessive thinking and pondering, I might tire my body. That is, if one continually uses too much reflection, too much analysis, too much investigation, I don't know why he says the body becomes tired, but what becomes tired is the mind. So he says, my body becomes tired, then my mind becomes strained. And when the mind is strained, it is far from concentration, from samadhi. Okay, so I steadied my mind internally, made it quiet down, brought it to singleness, and concentrated it. Why is that? So that my mind should not be strained. Okay, so here, first the Buddha, in order to strengthen the thought of desirelessness or renunciation, he reflects on the benefits of that thought. And to reflect on the benefits of it, he's using vitakka and vichara, thought and examination. And this is taking the form of discursive thinking, reflection, analysis. But when one is using reflection and analysis too much, then the mind tends to become strained and even scattered, because there are many objects that one is reflecting on. So once the Buddha is able to weaken the thought of sensual desire and establish it in this state of desirelessness through reflection, then he lets the reflection drop away and just brings the mind to some single object. This would be something like the in and out breathing, in order to make the mind well focused, to quiet it down, and to remove all of the thinking. So the mind will enter samadhi, one-pointed absorption of the mind. Okay, then he repeats the same thing with the thought of non-ill will. The thought of what's called non-ill will is actually the thought of loving kindness. So he will reflect on the benefits of loving kindness, and then he will radiate loving kindness to all beings using the power of thought and reflection. And then the thought of non-cruelty, this would be the thinking about the benefits of compassion and harmlessness, and then radiating thoughts of compassion towards others. And so he uses the same reflection, this thought of non-ill will, non-cruelty has arisen in me. This doesn't lead to my own affliction, to the affliction of others, to the affliction of both. It aids wisdom, does not cause distress, and it leads to nirvana. But if, again, if he thinks in this way, too much, day in, day out, night and day, then the mind becomes strained because of too much excessive thinking. And so again, once his mind becomes well established in these qualities of loving kindness and compassion, then he lets the thinking drop away, and he brings the mind to a single object and lets the mind drop into samadhi. Okay, now, again, he's applying the lesson, drawing out the lesson for in the assembly for the monks, but again, in the case of any person. Whatever, I'm in paragraph 11, whatever a person frequently thinks and ponders, that becomes the inclination of the mind. If one frequently thinks and ponders thoughts of renunciation, then one abandons the thought of sensual desire, one cultivates the thought of renunciation, and the mind inclines to thoughts of renunciation. Similarly, with thoughts of non-ill will, thoughts of non-cruelty. So in this case, one abandons the unwholesome thought, one develops the wholesome thought, and one's mind, by repeatedly thinking about those wholesome thoughts, one builds up the inclination to them. So this actually agrees very much with the statement we came across in the Salaika Sutta, Sutta number 8. This is on page 127, where the Buddha says, even the inclination of mind towards wholesome states or wholesome qualities is of great benefit. So what should be said of bodily and verbal acts conforming to that inclination? So you could use this repeated reflection with any list of wholesome qualities. For example, you can use it every day with, you could take the 6 paramitas of the northern tradition or the 10 paramis of the southern tradition. And just if you reflect, just even briefly, on each of these qualities, just for a moment, every day, as part of your regular meditation practice, what you're doing is planting seeds in the mind and then watering these seeds so that those tendencies are growing up. So say if you take the 6 paramis, or 6 paramitas, generosity, moral behavior, ethical behavior, patience, energy, meditation, wisdom, just reflect briefly on these qualities and they'll become tendencies of the mind. And when you do this every day, it's building up more and more strongly those tendencies in the mind. You could add to those 6 paramitas and the 4 brahmaviharas, loving kindness, compassion, altruistic joy, and equanimity. Or the 10 paramis of the southern tradition, generosity, ethical behavior, renunciation, I changed the order a little bit. Energy, patience, truthfulness, determination, loving kindness, wisdom, and equanimity. Or you can take the 37 factors or aids to enlightenment, but that's quite a lot. It takes more time. So this is a way of giving the direction to the mind, but it's important you don't just do it once and then think, ah, that's the direction it'll take, but do it every day, unless you're really ill or you have something to do urgently, but otherwise, if you have a regular practice, don't just sit trying to make the mind blank, but at the beginning, give the mind some direction by letting it turn over certain lists or collections of wholesome qualities. Okay, now the Buddha brings in the simile. It's just as in the last month of the hot season. Now all of the crops have been collected, brought into the village, so there are no more crops growing. They're not yet. They're still just, the seeds have just been planted. And so the cowherd doesn't have to look at the cows, but he just, while guarding the cows, he just lies down at the root of a tree with his iPod set over, plugged into his ear, or reading a magazine. And once in a while, he'll just peek up and take a look at the cows to make sure that they're not wandering off and getting lost. And so when the mind is well trained, you know, it doesn't repeatedly have to hammer the mind not to go wandering into the fields of the unwholesome thoughts, but just to be mindful of what kind of qualities are there. Okay, then comes, after explaining how he trained the mind, there comes the Buddha's, he repeats the story of his enlightenment. We're going to come to this later, in the later sutta, so I won't take it now. But he goes through the three super knowledges that he achieved. And now, paragraph 25, he uses a very powerful simile to show his own, to illustrate his own role as the teacher. And he uses the simile of a herd of deer. Okay, suppose that there was a wooded range. In a wooded range, there was a great low-lying marsh near which a large herd of deer was living. Then a man appeared desiring their ruin, their harm, wishing to trap them. And he would close off the safe path, and he would open up a false path, a path that will lead to the traps. He'll put out a decoy and set up a dummy. Maybe it would be a dummy of a large deer with antlers, so that all the deer would think that's our leader and they will go to him. In this way, that large herd of deer would later come upon calamity, disaster, and loss. Okay, but then another man comes along, desiring their good welfare and protection, and he will reopen the safe path, and he will close off the false path. He removes the decoy and destroys the dummy. And in this way, the large herd of deer might later come to growth, increase, and fulfillment. Okay, so that is the simile. Now the Buddha gives the explanation. He says, I have given this simile in order to convey a meaning. This is the meaning. The great low-lying marsh is a term for sensual pleasures. And this is what attracts living beings, is enjoyment of sensual pleasures. And when they follow that path, then they get caught and trapped. Then the large herd of deer is a synonym for sentient beings. The man desiring their ruin, harm, and bondage is a term for Mara, the evil one. Mara is like something like the devil, except that he doesn't have any connection with hell, but he is the lord of the heavens of sensual delight, who wants to lead living beings away from liberation and to sort of trap them with the temptation of sensual enjoyment. The false path is the wrong eightfold path. That's wrong view, right, wrong intention, and so on up to wrong concentration. The decoy is a term for delight and lust. The dummy is a term for ignorance. Okay, so those are the negative qualities. Then the man who comes along desiring their good welfare and protection, that's a term for the Tathagata, the Buddha, the accomplished one, the fully enlightened one. And the safe path to be traveled joyfully is a term for the Noble Eightfold Path, from right view to right concentration. Then the Buddha says, the safe and good path has been opened up by me, the wrong path has been closed off, the decoy removed, the dummy has been destroyed. What should be done for his disciples out of compassion by a teacher who seeks their welfare and has compassion for them, that I have done for you. Here are these roots of trees, the empty huts. Meditate, bhikkhus, do not delay, or else you will regret it later. That is our instruction to you. And that is the end of the sutta. Okay, maybe I don't really have time for questions right now, but Maybe if there's one question, an urgent question, I'll take it. Somebody who's not going to stay for the question, period.
There's questions in front of you.
This is a little technical question, so I didn't want to bring it up. You won't stay for the discussion.
I'll stay, but I just want to go back to the malaria issue.
To what?
To the malaria issue. If there was malaria, what would you have done?
I would have moved out from that area, gone to a different area. Or there are things that one could burn in the room that keep the mosquitoes away. There are these mosquito coils that you burn it. It's like incense, except that it has a repellent, a mosquito repellent. But if it's a malaria-infected area, I would keep away from it. Okay, we'll end now and then come back at 12 o'clock, around 12 o'clock, for the discussion period. One thing I want to announce now, I won't have the class on February 13th, though it's on the syllabus, because that's the day before the Chinese New Year, and so there'll be a lot of activity going on here, preparations for the Chinese New Year. And so I think it's better that we don't have the class that day. But do come on February 14th for the Chinese New Year celebration. It's very nice, and I think we will have some chanting in the afternoon and give out the protective thread that you put on your wrist, and it will protect you through the rest of the year. Okay, so we'll end with the sharing of the merits, to share the merits with the deities, the Nagas or dragon spirits, and the Buddhas, fear spirits, and with all the Akasata Jabumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantang Anumodiva Chirang Rakantu Sasanam Akasata Jabumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantang Anumodiva Chirang Rakantu Desana Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantang Anumodiva Chirang Rakantu Mantaram. Okay, the short style. Etavatacham Hehi Sampadang Punya Sampadang Sabe Deva Modantu, sabe bhutanu modantu, sabe satanu modantu, sabha sampati siddhya, bhavagupadaya avici hitato, etantare satakayupapanna, rupi arupicha, asanya sanino. Dukkha pamucchantu pusantu nibbutim. Okay, we stand.
Half hour.